This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening, Africa, and welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Jason Patinkin, and here's what's coming up.
The devastating surge of cases and deaths in India and increases in other regions of the world are clear signs of the risk of resurgence in African countries. The toxic mix driving this upsurge is present here in Africa.
That was Matshidiso Moet, the World Health Organization's Regional Director for Africa, on the need for African countries to avoid complacency in the fight against COVID-19. This story and more coming up on Africa News Tonight. The World Health Organization urges African countries to be on guard and remain vigilant in their fight against a resurgence of COVID-19 transmission across the continent. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
To date, African countries are reporting more than 4.5 million cases of COVID-19, including 120,000 deaths. WHO Regional Director for Africa, Matshidiso Moet, says the latest figures indicate this deadly virus has continued to plateau on the continent. While welcoming a seemingly good news, she warns the pandemic is trending upwards in 13 countries.
We cannot be lulled into a false sense of security as the continent's case count appears relatively stable. The devastating surge of cases and deaths in India and increases in other regions of the world are clear signs of the risk of resurgence in African countries. The toxic mix driving this upsurge is present here in Africa.
Moeti says countries are letting down their guard and weakening their adherence to preventive measures. She says super spreader events such as mass gatherings and population movements are increasing. Moeti points to a WHO analysis of 46 African countries that found almost half are facing a considerable risk of a surge. She says Africa must learn from the tragic situation unfolding in India and take precautions. Moeti adds that mass religious gatherings, large election campaign events, and the circulation of new variants of COVID-19 have triggered the explosive growth in cases and deaths throughout that country.
There probably has been a dropping off of the observation by the population of the masking, physical distancing and hand washing measures. I think the lesson that we can learn in Africa, one is to anticipate that such a wave is possible in different countries and to really look at what are some of the driving factors.
Moeti cites the importance of avoiding mass gatherings and maintaining proven public health measures, including masking, social distancing, testing, and tracing of contacts. Africa has obtained most of its COVID-19 vaccines from India through the COVAX vaccine sharing facility. This supply has dried up since India imposed an export ban on vaccines. The COVAX vaccine distribution plan's goal is to deliver millions of vaccine doses to low-income countries, including in Africa. Moeti says it is understandable that India wants to use these vaccines to immunize its own population. However, she says she's very concerned about delays in obtaining these life-saving vaccines. She says Africa will have to find alternative supplies if it is to have any chance of stopping the coronavirus from spreading. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Now in Chad, the ruling military council has named new ministers to lead the transitional government for the next 18 months. Three of the 40 cabinet members are from opposition parties, although many other opposition politicians have stood against the transitional government. The military took control of Chad's government last month after President Idriss Deby died of battlefield wounds. It is being led by Deby's son, General Mohamed Idriss Deby, who promises elections will be held in 18 months. Longtime opposition politician Saleh Kebzabo was not named to the transitional government, but has said he recognizes it. Also in Chad, Chadian troops are part of the UN peacekeeping force in Mali, and they are a key component in the fight against jihadists in northeastern Nigeria. France has been seeking to boost the involvement of Sahel countries in the anti-jihadist fight and scale back its own deployment of 5,100 troops. Following the death of President Deby, Chad might bring its soldiers back to its own soil, however. Joseph Siegel is the director of research at the Africa Center for Strategic Studies. He speaks about this possibility to VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi.
Well, Chad is the largest troop contributor to MINUSMA with some 1,400 troops. It has another 1,200 troops that it deploys along the border with Mali, Niger, and Burkina Faso. So it's playing a very important role for helping to stabilize the cross-border movements of violent extremist groups in the Sahel. I think it's important, though, to note that, you know, security forces are a necessary but insufficient element of countering insurgencies. In addition to the military force, you need to have more domestic efforts. You need to have a government presence. There need to be provision of services. You need to have the trust of local populations. There need to be some anti-poverty initiatives. In short, you need to have a stronger community ties, that you build that trust in cooperation with the community, and in that way deny access to the violent extremist groups. So the role of the Chadians is important, and I think it's tenuous now to see whether they'll continue that support, but it isn't the sole factor. And in fact, arguably, it's not the most important factor for stabilizing the Sahel.
France has been seeking to boost the involvement of Sahel countries in the anti-jihadist fight and scale back its own deployment of 5,100 men. If Chad brings its soldiers back, what could be the security risks for Mali, Burkina Faso, and Niger?
Right now, the Sahel is facing a security crisis. You know, we've seen an increase in violent extremist attacks of 44% in the past year, most of that concentrated in Mali and northern Burkina Faso. And, you know, these are expansive regions with long, porous borders, difficult terrain. And so it's a challenge by any count to provide security, especially among countries with limited resources and government capabilities. So the potential loss of the Chadian forces would be a significant blow to the regional security efforts in the Sahel. So I think this points again to the challenges when these regional efforts are dependent on unstable autocratic governments. And so we have to expect that they're going to face these political crises and then reassess and redirect their forces as a result.
Another potential impact of Deby's death could be felt in southern Libya, a lawless desert region from where the revolt in northeastern Chad began. Could Deby's death contribute to the resurgence of the Islamic State in the region?
I don't see there being a strong connection between Deby's death and a resurgence of ISIS. You know, we've seen a trajectory of ISIS engagement in Libya on a downward path for a number of years now. And most of the ISIS activity was in the north of Libya. And so the factors that have led to ISIS's diminishment are independent of Chad. Moreover, as you note, you know, a number of the armed opposition groups for Chad are based in southern Libya. So Chad doesn't have very much influence in what's going on in southern Libya. And so I don't see that Deby's death providing any space or opening for an ISIS resurgence.
That was Joseph Siegel, Director of Research at the Africa Center for Strategic Studies, speaking with VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi. Meanwhile, the UN Human Rights Office condemned the deadly crackdown by Chad's security forces against peaceful protesters demanding a return to civilian rule. Lisa Schlein again has a story for us from Geneva.
Nationwide demonstrations throughout the past week have been met with a fierce response by Chad's defense and security forces, who reportedly killed six people on Tuesday and wounded several others. The UN Human Rights Office expresses grave concern at this excessive, disproportionate use of force, including the use of live ammunition against peaceful protesters. In addition, UN Human Rights spokeswoman Marta Hurtado says 700 people reportedly have been arrested. She says those actions are in violation of international law, which obliges countries to protect and respect human rights, including the right of freedom of peaceful assembly.
The decree imposing a blanket ban on demonstrations without prior authorization may undermine the exercise of the right to peaceful assembly. We also note that the Transitional Military Council itself declared on 20 April that it would abide by Chad international treaty obligations.
Chad's president, Idriss Deby, was killed by rebels on April 20th. Chad's military appointed a Transitional Military Council headed by Deby's son, Mohamed Idriss Deby, until new elections were to be held in 18 months. Hurtado says that decree has elicited an outcry of protest from Chad's political opposition, triggering mass demonstrations against continued military rule.
The people on the street are demanding that the country comes back to the constitutional order and civilian rule. They have been demonstrating, as said, they want the authorities to hear their demands.
The UN Human Rights Office is calling on state authorities to conduct impartial, effective, and transparent investigations into human rights violations that may have occurred, including the use of excessive force against protesters. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
South African President Cyril Ramaphosa spent 3 days testifying before a commission of inquiry into corruption that's come to be known as state capture, but critics have described his statements as vague and disappointing. Ramaphosa said the ruling African National Congress, or ANC, had, quote, failed to act soon enough, end quote, when his predecessor, Jacob Zuma, and his acolytes were allegedly stealing billions of dollars from state-owned companies. Much of the alleged graft happened when Ramaphosa was Zuma's deputy. Darren Taylor reports.
The ANC, which recently celebrated its 119th birthday, is Africa's oldest liberation movement. It's been in power for 27 years, since the country's first democratic elections officially ended apartheid. But President Ramaphosa told the inquiry the ANC needs more time to mature before it's able to deal decisively with corrupt members.
The president is talking absolute nonsense. The ANC doesn't need more time.
Eusebius Mkhize's an independent political commentator.
If since 1994 and before, you could not engender a culture of ethical leadership and responsiveness to the needs of citizens, then you will not be able to do so going forward because you've had ample opportunity.
He says the ANC's had ample opportunity to ensure the implementation of its many resolutions against graft.
Many times the ANC will take a resolution that says the next decade is the decade of the cadre, where we will develop technically skilled cadres that will be seconded into the state, who are both brilliant at their jobs from a technical point of view, but also have deep ethical sense of what an ethical leader and an ethical civil servant is meant to do. We've got to judge the
But Mkhize maintains this never happens, and competent ethical officials in government remain few and far between. Yet, during his testimony, Ramaphosa insisted corrupt leaders are rare anomalies in the ANC, and even though he was deputy president at the time, he and the broader ANC didn't know what Zuma and others were allegedly up to. Rubbish is Mkhize's reaction.
They did know because the kind of monies that were flowing into the ANC made the ANC one of the richest political parties in the world. The Treasurer General of the ANC, each successive one, was effectively like a conduit for money to flow in from private interests into the ANC. The idea that the ANC is itself a victim of one or two bad apples is simply factually untrue.
But political analyst Prince Mashele says Ramaphosa's evidence that he didn't know about all the corruption during the Zuma years is exactly what he expected from an astute politician.
He knows, he was well advised, that if he had said that he knew, That in itself would have constituted a criminal offense in terms of the Prevention of Corruption Act. So he actually was playing a legal game there. It is not true that he did not know. But I understand why he does not admit. It's because he does not want to incriminate himself.
But for Makhiza, Ramaphosa's denialism, as he describes it, remains deeply disturbing.
That lack of accountability from ANC President Cyril Ramaphosa says to me that we can't trust the ANC in terms of its future orientation to honestly self-examine and to honestly and faithfully implement any plans to try and create a new kind of ANC cadre, because it can't even be honest about past malfeasance.
Questions remain about who gave 300 million rands to Ramaphosa's campaign to unseat Zuma. The president told the inquiry he still doesn't know the identities of his funders. Some political parties claim the money was used to bribe senior ANC members to turn against Zuma. Ramaphosa denies this. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
One of Nigeria's most notorious bandit leaders, who recently recanted on his pledge to abandon banditry, has been killed in a fight with rival gangs, VOA's House of Service reports. 2 weeks ago, Aminu Daudawa announced he was reneging on his amnesty deal with authorities to stop banditry at an elaborate ceremony staged by the Zamfara government. Daudawa allegedly was behind the kidnapping of more than 500 students in Niger State last December. However, after talks with the government in February, Daudawa and his men surrendered their guns and vowed to help end insecurity. The world's oceans are under threat from climate change, loss of biodiversity, and overfishing. A study in the journal Nature says that if nations protected 30% of the oceans, it would increase fish stocks, maintain biodiversity, and preserve marine carbon stocks, which contribute to climate change when released by industrial fishing trawlers, for example. VOA's Adam Phillips spoke with Nigerian-born Rashid Sumaila, an oceans and fisheries economist at the University of British Columbia in Canada.
Absolutely. And you need to understand the science, you need to understand the economics, you need to understand the social culture, the legal. So, yeah, it's bringing all the perspective to the table because people and nature interact.
In the past, what has been the overall approach in protecting biodiversity, mitigating climate change, and promoting sustainable economic development, especially regarding fisheries and such?
Before this study, people were looking at the effects of climate change separate from the biodiversity and separate from the food and livelihood.
And the studies made insight regarding this?
When we talk about conserving nature or conserving the ocean, we are also at the same time talking about future jobs and food. They are intertwined. So you cannot take down nature and hope to continue to get what nature provides us, which is every basic thing that is important to us. The fish, the forest, the oil, the gas. We take them into our economy, into our cultural, social systems, and then we produce waste and we put them back into the ocean, into nature. If we don't do the taking wisely and we don't take care of the waste that we produce, we are going to destroy the basis of life.
So the ocean matters to everybody, not just those living on the coastlines and fishermen, etc.?
Yes. If you are in Abuja, not by the coast, and you think that the ocean doesn't matter to you, you are making a mistake, because through trade, we get fish to eat, whether you are in Abuja or in Nairobi or in Cape Town, right? Also remember, the ocean produces half the oxygen on Earth. Without oxygen, we are all gone. So preserving nature links with our food needs, our livelihoods, and also leads to climate. And that is the point of this paper.
So what does the paper actually say?
Essentially, what the paper says is that if you protect the ocean, up to 30% of it, could be more, then you buy yourself insurance, you build in resilience in your system, and actually you also can reduce your cost of fishing because the protected area becomes more productive and you can catch the fish cheaply without burning too much carbon and making CO2 and climate change. And in the report, there are specific data for each country in Africa. For example, in Nairobi, the report has found out that the amount of the ocean protected fully from fishing is zero. So that means Kenya has a lot to do. Then you go to South Africa. They have about, if I remember well, they have about 2-3% fully protected. So each country can see where they are doing well. And then the amount of fish you can get more if you do this protection, you know, how many jobs can you create a livelihood? So you can see where you are and how to increase your food, protect the environment, and also deal with climate change.
It sounds quite doable.
It's a 3-point dividend there. Win, win, win. If only we can do it.
It must be frustrating for scientists like you when policymakers hesitate to adopt these ideas.
Absolutely. It's almost like you see the path, you see the way to really improve the lives of everybody, and yet we just go on doing all the things that really destroy nature and us ultimately. So yeah, this is tough, but my own way of tackling this is we have to be optimistic. We have to keep pushing. So let's keep going. Africa will do well if we put things in place.
That was Rashid Sumaila, an oceans and fisheries economist at the University of British Columbia, speaking with VOA's Adam Phillips. The killings in Burkina Faso of two Spanish journalists, along with an Irish conservationist, have underscored the risks reporters face in Africa's Sahel region. Press freedom supporters say threats to journalists have been growing in the Sahel, along with Islamist insurgencies in the region. Ahead of World Press Freedom Day on Monday, Annie Reisenberg reports from Bamako, Mali.
The bodies of Spanish journalists David Berrien and Roberto Frail arrived in Spain on Friday. They were working on a documentary about poaching with Irish conservationist Rory Young in eastern Burkina Faso this week when they were ambushed, abducted, and killed. A Burkinabe soldier accompanying the group on Monday is still missing. The Associated Press reported an Al-Qaeda-linked jihadist group claimed responsibility for the attack. Whoever was responsible, the killings underscored the increasing risks of reporting in parts of Burkina Faso and its Sahel region neighbors, Mali and Niger. The UN's refugee agency says armed violence in the Sahel has displaced nearly 3 million people since 2018. Jean-Louis Wango is a freelance journalist based in Burkina Faso's eastern region capital, Fadangorma, just an hour's drive from Pama Reserve, near where the Europeans were attacked. Speaking via a messaging application, Wango says the country's growing violence has limited the ability of journalists to do their work. We have so many subjects that we can talk about in the provinces, he says. In the eastern region, there are 5 provinces. We used to move around a lot to report. But in the last 4 years, says Wango, we can't venture out like that anymore to do any reporting in the provinces. Mahamadou Savadogo is an independent security consultant in Burkina Faso and a Sahel extremism researcher for a Senegal-based think tank. Speaking from Ouagadougou via a messaging application, he said the road the Europeans were driving on when attacked has been controlled by armed terrorists since 2019. I can even say that it is a suicide, he says, to take this road, because it's a road that we know if you take, you won't have a chance to reach the end. Savadogo says the risk of being targeted is especially high if you're escorted by the armed forces or other security. It's not clear how much of a risk the Irish conservationist and Spanish journalists knew they were taking. The New York City-based Committee to Protect Journalists, CPJ, this week called for the authorities to investigate the killings. Speaking from New York via a messaging application, CPJ Africa Program Director Angela Quintal noted worsening security for reporting in the Sahel.
The situation for journalists generally is not good. I mean, just recently, you know, one of the top investigative journalists in Burkina Faso is now facing criminal defamation, and he's been sued by the ruling party, I mean, Lajibama, right? So all of this, including the fact that, you know, journalists who are trying to cover the insurgency, what's happening in Burkina Faso and the Sahel generally, are really putting themselves at great danger.
The Association of Journalists of Burkina echoed the call for an investigation. But bringing terrorists to justice in the Sahel is unlikely. Quintal says CPJ research shows that globally, in about 80% of cases where journalists are killed, the killers walk free. Annie Reisenberg for VOA News, Bamako, Mali.
And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Jason Patinkin in Washington. For all latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, McPhil Yabarro, and our editor, Paul Alexander, thank you for tuning in and choosing The Voice of America. Stay safe, stay healthy. Have a great day.